can hold my breath. I can bite my tongue. I can stay awake for days if that's what you want. Be a number one. I can fake a smile. I can force a laugh. I can dance and play the part if that's what you ask. Give you all. I'm only human. I can turn it on. Be a good machine. I can hold the weight of worlds if that's what you need.
Last year, more migrants entered the EU than the 2015 refugee crisis. Yet policymakers turn a blind eye to what looks like the start of an unprecedented climate refugee crisis, which could quickly destabilize Europe's social order. And Turkey's case proved that we are far from being prepared. Together with Syria, they suffered the most severe earthquake in almost a century. 300,000 people were displaced from Turkey to Syria in almost a week. International law gives no protection to climate refugees. In fact, we don't even agree on who counts as one. Without legal status, climate refugees slip through the cracks of global frameworks without safety nets or legal migration options. And the EU insists on wasting billions of euros in border walls and fences equivalent to nearly 12 Berlin walls. I'm Katerina Badzaki. And in today's Infinite Curious program of Earth's Voice of Greece, Thessaloniki's 25th Dog Festival gives us enough food for thought to dive into the world of climate refugees through the lens of film director Angelos Rallis. Angelos Rallis is a documentary filmmaker and photojournalist who began his career as a theatre director for Hellenic broadcaster ERT and the University of Athens. He has since embarked on a long-term project based on his studies in visual sociology, researching the emerging cultures and communities of East London, and has directed the award-winning documentaries such as A Place for Everyone and Shingal, Where Art You? In his new documentary, Mighty Afrin in the Time of Floods, which premieres and competes at the 25th Documentary Salonika Festival, his main character, Afrin, is a 12-year-old girl from Bangladesh who faces the harsh reality of being a climate refugee. Angela, good morning and welcome to our program.
Good morning. Thank you very much for your invitation.
Why did you pick a 12-year-old girl from Bangladesh to tell your story?
My wife, she used to work on a project creating resilient shelters for the people who suffer due to floods and typhoons in the area. So I started visiting the area with her and realized that people in the Brahmaputra River areas, they are living every year, maybe around 5-6 months in water. There is a lot of river islands, the Brahmaputra. These islands are constantly changing, vanishing, and reappearing in the middle of the riverbank. So I initially was planning to make a documentary about the people who live there, and when the flood is coming and the cyclones, they move to the cities because everything is flooded, and then they seek some temporary job for half a year, and then they go back when the water recedes. But while I was researching in the midst of such ongoing events, I encountered Afrin, the main character of my film, as you said. Afrin was searching all alone for valuables along the river. I was amazed by her ability to live in this context. What is other people's waste is treasure for her.
For example?
It's a place where there is no electricity. Kids like Afrin, who is an orphan child, they need to use any material they find, like a piece of wood to make a doll, for example, or they're fishing in river, this is their food. Even a little piece of plastic or tires from cars, they will pick it up and they will make their toys. So it was very impressive for me to observe that.
Where does Afrin live?
Afrin lives in one of these river islands in the Brahmaputra. It's a very wide river, maybe 7 kilometers wide, so people call it a sea. But it's a big river, and it has thousands of little mud islands that there is no stone or construction. It's just sand, and a lot of people, due to the land ownership issue in the area, they move there, even in this context with floods and cyclones, and they live there basically all their life. As soon as the island gets ravaged by the floods and winds, they will relocate to some other place. Afrin is the representation of a generation of children like her, put forward in desperate times, because there is thousands of children who live in this context. So basically, it's not only her, but it's many people. That's why I chose to concentrate on a child, because difficult for adults and families in this context, for an orphan child, it's extremely difficult to cope in this kind of situation. So Afrin reflects this battle against uncertainty and fear, flood and poverty in the area.
Does Afrin live on her own?
Yes, Afrin is orphaned by mother. Her mother died when she was very young, and her father left in order to seek work in the capital. These factories, they make clothes for European fabrics and big brands. It's a cheap labor factories, and a lot of people from these flood-prone areas, they moved to the city to seek some job of this kind. So her father left, but he never came back. Basically, Afrin has grown from 3-4 years old until now. I mean, the film started when she was 12 on her own. There is some neighbors around, but, you know, Afrin in this context is seen more as a burden. Everyone is poor and, you know, nobody could really look after her.
Does she have a roof over her head?
Yes, she has a roof. I mean, it's corrugated iron constructions, so it's not a proper housing. It's more like a very basic bamboo furniture where people make on their own.
In Bangladesh, we know there's a history of children being abducted, exploited. I mean, there's a lot of dangers behind that.
Yes, definitely. The situation is even more complicated because a lot of men during the flood time, they will leave. They will go to find some labor work, but women usually stay at the flooded areas. As you understand, during these times, you know, there is no electricity, even toilet is flooded. So it is a serious health issue and concern about there's no hospital, there's no one that will come to save them during the flood. So people need to find ways to adapt. Bangladesh is a country where there's a lot of forced prostitution and gender issues.
Who takes care of Afrin?
Afrin looks after herself. She was all this time fishing her food, cultivating what she can cultivate around the house. There is some far relatives around, like her aunt. But her aunt herself, she has three children and sees Afrin more as another burden that she cannot afford. The water is increasing 1 meter, 2 meters, 3 meters, and eventually it ends up until the roof, the metal roof of the houses. What Afrin does is she cuts a banana tree, she makes a raft. That's the first thing. She puts her animals, and she will put the goat on the raft, and all the people have adjusted their house to have a platform. In the upper level of the house, they move into this platform, and they sleep there, and they cook there. The house is flooded inside, and when the platform gets also flooded, then they move in the roof. They have no information when the flood will come. It just can come in 6 hours over the night. And the flood can last for months, from March to October is in high risk. It depends also on where everybody's house is situated. There is upper and lower ground. I mean, the lower ground is almost is flooded all the period. Situation where you really need to collect drinking water from rain and live on stock, basically. Any dry food you have saved or, you know, fishing, that's the way to survive in this context.
Does this apply to all residents there or the richer get away with it?
Yes, I mean, of course, there are class, even in this very poor setting. There is class distinction. Some people, they have a little business maybe in the mainland, so they could do something more. No, they have a little boat, engine boat, that they could leave. And most of the people, they can't afford that. And the poorest people will row all the way to the shore, which is like maybe 6-7 kilometers, can take a day to row all the way because there's different streams and it's not easy. Also, it's quite dangerous.
Where do they go?
Yeah, I mean, I follow my character and these 5 years suffering. The first 2 years she would remain, and then she decided to leave and go to Dhaka, to the big capital, big metropolis, the capital of Bangladesh. And there they try to make a living by doing anything. It's for young children, they live in the streets, they're homeless. So they would stay in shelters made of cardboard in the streets, on the margins of the city, on the beach, anywhere they find. And the entry job for them is to recycle. So basically, they recycle and they also burn rubbish. It's a job. They are called tokais. And it's the children who burn rubbish in every area of the city. Dhaka doesn't have a rubbish collection system for all the city, so most of them, the neighbors, they burn the rubbish. And they sort of employ little children to do that. So she's collecting, the children are collecting and burning rubbish. 10 million people that have gone through the last decade in Bangladesh, they move to the city and they try to, you know, find any type of job. people are paying money to factory owners of big clothes manufacturers in order to get a job, which is maybe something like $40, $50 a month. No.
Hold on. They're paying money, the company, to hire them.
Not to the company directly, but to some, person in charge there, no? It's sort of like, in order to get a job. Otherwise, he would give a job to someone else who is queuing. In the case of Afrin found what the job in the recycling industry, partly also because it's not easy to fill in the factories. There's a lot of debate in Europe about clothes manufacturers in Bangladesh. You know, if you remember, there was this H&M factories that had the fire and hundreds of people died. And so since then, it's not easy to fill in these areas, to get permission to film there. So I couldn't film there, but I could film on the streets, Afrin and the other children trying to make a living in the margins of the city, recycling and burning rubbish, which was her job for about a year and a half.
In the 5 years you've been following Afrin, were there times where you were tempted to help her?
During this time I was filming in Afrin, but also now following that, I have tried to look after Afrin in several ways. I mean, just giving some money here and there, it's not, it's important to go by, but at the same time, I wanted to create something more resilient for her for the future. Of course, also during this shooting, I was making sure that Afrin is safe, also in the island, and there was also a lot of safety measures that I had to take, but also in association also with my local partner in Bangladesh, my assistant director, who was keeping an eye with a number of people. So we set up a whole mechanism to be able to make sure first that Afrin is safe, and also that, in the future, after filming this journey, coming-of-age journey, as I call it, from the island to the city, that is not going to be risky for her. And, this involves like riding a train on the roof as people travel because they have no money to pay a fare. They will travel on the roof of the train. It's like 70 kilometers speed. It's quite dangerous. And in Dhaka, obviously in recycling and rubbish areas, it's very polluting and not the right place for children to be. So not only Afrin, in the end, the production team, we had to look after quite a lot of children. And following that journey, once the film was finished, we secured a safe place for Afrin in the context of a local NGO who provides a shelter and schooling and quite a lot of facilities for orphan children. And themselves also, once the children get integrated, then they reach out also to other children in the streets, who are in Dhaka on their own, and they provide support.
When these kids turn 17 or 18, do they leave the country? Do they go somewhere else? And where do they go?
Yes, many children or adults, they leave them. Some choose to leave for Europe, no? Not everyone can afford that. But of course, it is very attractive idea to them to manage to come to Europe eventually, no? But, of course, this is not easy at all. We know now from the experience in Europe since the last 10 years or 20 years, refugees and immigrants having to walk from Southeast Asia or Africa for thousands of kilometers to reach, the borders of Europe and take a boat. Some of these people in Bangladesh, eventually, they will cross. They will come to Europe. They will try to find shelter in Europe.
So after filming this documentary, living there in Bangladesh for 5 years and filming for 6 months and following Afrin, what are the things that you have learned from this experience, and what do you think should be done to help climate refugees?
It has been a lifetime experience for me to experience climate change in Brahmaputra. Definitely I've met so many people and get to know how difficult is the life there, but also the ingenuity and the remarkable resilience of these people was astonishing. People have learned how to cope with these disasters and learn to adapt to some extent. And children like Afrin, you know, radiate this ability to get away with pretty much everything. At the same time, I think in terms of climate change, I think firstly it would be good to recognize climate refugees officially and worldwide, because it is a reality. People are forced to abandon their places, their houses, their areas due to climate change. So it would definitely help for the United Nations, the governments, to recognize the fact that they exist and to create a legislation that will allow them to receive help if they seek refuge in another country, but also within the affected countries. That will be some way to start.
Okay.
Of course, also relief, you know, during the disaster. It's, everybody there was complaining about that. They actually told me, you know, in Europe, once there is a disaster, there is helicopters around, or, you know, in Greece there was a fire last year, and there is helicopters, there is boats, there is some type of relief, no? But here, we are on our own. If I die here, someone, I remember, said, you know, nobody will find me. So it's a little bit summarizes everything.
Angeli, thank you for joining our Infinite Curious program this morning, and good luck with your film. And I guess Afrin could be an example to follow and to try to help people like Afrin and other people to avoid these kind of situations, especially when it comes to small children.
Yes, thank you very much for the invitation to talk here today. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Have a very nice day.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
And that was documentary filmmaker and photojournalist Angelos Rallis challenging our curious minds with the complex topic of climate migration in his new film, Mighty Afrin, In the Time of Floods. The film's world premiere will take place at the 25th Documentary Festival of Salonika on the 7th of March at Olympian Theatre in Thessaloniki at 8:15 in the evening. Angelos's film is a mighty example why, in the face of changing environmental, economic and security concerns, governments should facilitate safe and orderly migration and incorporate migration as a climate adaptation strategy into their development agendas. Welcome back to the second part of our Infinite Curious program of The Voice of Greece. From the late 60s to the mid-80s, in the notorious Times Square area of New York, known as the Juice, the eccentric Greek-born Chelly Wilson built a porn cinema empire and a reputation as one of the most savvy and charismatic figures on the scene. With a cigarette in hand and bags of money stashed in the corner, Celi regularly held court in her bunker-like apartment above the legendary 8th Avenue all-male Avonlea Theatre, summoning a lively cabal of associates, entertainers and fellow poker players, with her female lovers always hovering and grandchildren often underfoot. Yet few in her circle knew of the risks she took to get there. Accomplished director Valerie Kontakos, in her new film, which also competes in the 25th Documentary Festival of Thessaloniki and premieres there in Europe for the first time, Queen of the Juice reveals Celi's origins as a taboo-breaking entrepreneur and traces the fraught events that lead to her departure from Europe on the eve of the war and the unconventional trajectories of her American business ventures and personal life. Valerie, good morning and welcome to our program.
Hello there. That was a very nice intro. Thank you. She sounds fantastic.
Well, I wanted to start by asking you, and watching the film and also going through your biography, you're a native New Yorker going back and forth between Athens and the Big Apple, on the board of directors of the Greek Cinematheque for over a decade, and with your film Manna, which went viral during the 2018 wildfires in Greece, we could do a whole interview just for that. You also helped the nuns there to build back the orphanage. So Queen of the Juice is not your first feature film on social outreach. Yet, why in a time where the Me Too movement is stronger than ever, when Greece is probably one of the first countries in Europe in human trafficking after Spain, and female porn exploitation and abduction is thriving, why did you pick to film a story about a woman who basically exploited other women to make money?
Let me give you a little bit of background. I knew Celi from the time I was about 15 years old because I had my first job in New York at the Tivoli on Sundays, which used to show Greek films. It was a part-time job. I wanted to be, you know, independent at 15. I was like, you know, I'm going to start making my own money and I'm going to, you know, take care of myself. So I had these ideas at that age.
And you worked for Celi, basically.
And yeah. I worked for Celi because she was a friend of my mother's family, because my mother's family was in film.
What did she say to you when you first met her?
Well, I don't remember what she said to me when I first met her because I was very young. It was many years before that that I had met her. I mean, she was just like this larger-than-life figure for me. But also because she was a friend of my mother's, I would always hear stories about Celi. And really, Celi for me was, you know, like I admired her because I, you know, at 15, 16, I would see this woman who basically could handle herself in any situation. And, you know, like when you're a teenage girl at that age, I mean, this sense of empowerment was very strong. And when you see it in someone, another woman, you admire it. So, you know, like I knew her many years. But also, I think what happened was that, I mean, my fascination, you know, like at 15, grew into, this questioning. At 18, when I'm in college and I'm becoming much more political and, you know, I understand things on a different level, and I'm thinking, you know, like, Celi, you know, like, she was exploiting people. I mean, that's the, you know, like, kind of started thinking along those lines. It took me until, you know, like, 40 years later to feel at ease to be able to make this film about her. Because at this point, I didn't feel as though I, you know, after you've lived so many years and you've seen things that have been going on around you, things come around in circles in a sense. And I think that you learn to see people with all their gray shades. And you understand, and learning about her background and so forth and so on, you understand what brings people to where they are. So, yeah, it took me until, you know, now, 40 years later, to feel okay about making this film and about focusing on her and being able to tell her story in a way that I felt comfortable saying it.
Yeah, because the way you describe her story is more like describing it in flying colors, in the sense that we don't get to see any shady thing in the story. I mean, I was watching the film and everybody spoke very well of her. I mean, we see a woman who's happy. I mean, we don't see the side where, okay, we do see some scenes where she gets a little depressed because of her background, because of the Holocaust, because of the situation that back in Greece, etc. But we always see a very strong woman giving money to everyone, helping everyone in every way she can. But at the same time, all this comes from shady money, okay? So it's quite interesting, I mean, to tell me that, because you seem to describe her in light.
Well, look, I don't think that the film basically, you know, makes her a saint. And I think even all the people who liked her knew exactly and do speak about everything that she did. And they all say that she was, you know, a finagler and you know, she would do things that weren't necessarily. I'd say that she didn't, you know, she has had gray areas, but I don't think ultimately those gray areas really hurt people or damaged people. And I think that's important. And I think that, yes, she was always happy, you know, the way we see her, you know, like that was her mode of survival, is to kind of be at the moment and to be grateful for what she had. I mean, you never, you know, like no one ever, you know, like talks about her complaining or whining or nagging or anything like that, even though I'm sure she had many reasons to do that, and yet she didn't. You know, she basically got on with life, did whatever needed to be done in order for her to be able, you know, like to go the next step. I mean, when you think about the fact that in 1939, when she left her daughter with a Greek family as a hidden Jewish girl in Athens, she had the wherewithal to tell the woman who was going to be taking care of her daughter that even if a family member comes to take her, to, you know, take her to be with the rest of her, of Chelli's family in Thessaloniki, she cannot give Paulette to anyone. That was major for her to be able to foresee something like that. And in fact, her brother did go to Athens to try to get Paulette to take her to Thessaloniki because he felt that the family had to be together. The rest of the family in Thessaloniki disappeared in Auschwitz.
Yes, because in the
Paulette
first...
Paulette would have disappeared.
Mm-hmm. In Auschwitz,
she had the wherewithal. Well, how many women are meant to be mothers? That's one question.
That's a very good question, actually, yes.
Right. We assume that, you know, because we're women, we're meant to be mothers. But on the other hand, no, she wasn't meant to be probably a mother, but she was in this situation and she did the best that she could for the circumstances. And I think she did pretty damn well. I mean, sure, she's, you know, like if you speak to her kids, I'm sure they have tons of things to say about her and why she wasn't good and blah, 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 blah. But so does everyone. But ultimately, she provided for them. She gave them safety. I mean, you know, like maybe she wasn't emotionally there. You know, I mean, that wasn't her forte. So, and as to whether, you know, like, was it bad that she had her lovers, her female lovers with her? I don't know. I mean, I suppose if she paid more attention to her female lovers than she did to her kids, yeah, you could say that that wasn't fair. But at the same time, you know, they could have been male lovers or, you know, it could have been something else. I don't think the gender or anything like that. I think it goes on anyway today. I mean, when you have people that have all these extramarital affairs, at least she was very open about it. And, you know, I think there's something to be said about that, that she was never apologetic. She was always open about everything. And we seem to think that, you know, like there should have been some kind of judgment to that. But on the other hand, I think we have to kind of, you know, and that's basically what I try to do in the film, is just to see things as much as possible through what made her do what she did and how she managed to do it.
I mean, she was one of the first, probably not even women, men and women between, you know, in New York, who actually created the first cinemas for gay people. And we see nowadays we have a rise of feminism, a sexual revolution. We didn't have those things in those days. It was more difficult. However, why do you say that Queen of the Jews is an alternate take on cultural history as seen through Shelley Wilson's empowering story of survival?
I think it's acceptance, number one, that and tolerance, number two. I mean, don't think she was really critical of people. I think she, you know, she took them for face value for what they were. She accepted them, and I think that there was, you know, like, between everyone, I think that there was respect, you know, in terms of how they behaved with each other. And I think that that's kind of undervalued these days, that we kind of take our judgments and we forget the fact that we have to just respect each other regardless of, you know, what anyone's preferences or what have you, to the extent that you're not hurting other people and you're not damaging people, that you accept people.
This actually brings me to my previous question about when I asked you about female porn exploitation, and I would really like you to draw some parallels between the situation today and the situation back then, because she started with soft porn, and when you're watching those films, it's true what someone said in your film, that you could nowadays be watching those films in the afternoon and nothing will happen compared to those days when you were watching those films, and it was a huge thing. So do you think that the morals and ethics have changed through the decades?
I hope so. You know, like, first of all, I hope the way I see things is that I hope that we're not as hypocritical as we were, number one, because I remember, I'll just give you an example of when we first moved to Greece, and, you know, we had our young children with us, and we would be driving down the main, you know, like if you see us or something like that. And my kids were like 8 or 9 years old. And I don't know if you remember, they used to have these banners on Kifisias that were advertisements for, I don't know, you know, like diet places or whatever. And there were these, you know, huge, like 2-meter, 3-meter high banners of women that were practically naked, you know, like except for something covering their rear end. And you could, you know, except for the nipple, you could see the breast and everything. And I would say, you know, like, what is going on here? I have these boys, you know, these young boys, and I'm driving down a main street, and I've got these huge posters of practically naked women, you know, as though nothing is happening. Well, isn't that a hypocrisy? I mean, we can do it if it's okay to show women, you know, like how they can make themselves beautiful, but at the same time, there's a certain amount of sexploitation there. But it's okay because it's, you know, commercial on a certain level. I just find that those things are...
Is it okay?
You know,
is it really okay?
I
mean, do you find that
so
we are evolving or is it some sort of degradation?
Of course it's degradation, but it's how we also read it and how we, you know, like I personally, you know, at that time with, you know, 2 young boys, I felt that it was unnecessary to advertise on that level, in that mode. And, you know, like, then we're, you know, we kind of wonder why there's all this, you know, exploitation. I mean, I find that the exploitation comes from within each of us and how we see our fellow, you know, human being.
You were saying earlier that she wasn't hurting anyone. And nowadays, we see exploitation. Like, we see a lot of women being abducted from Balkan countries, locked into rooms where they've been sexually abused, and some of them don't have the freedom to walk away, or they're being drugged, etc. So it's kind of like a forced labor.
First of all, I don't think that Chelly and what she was doing has anything to do with what we're talking about now as far as like female, you know, exploitation goes in terms of enslavement and all of these things. I think that there's so much to be said for abuse to anyone who is in any way in a weaker position, be it financial, be it, you know, gender, be it national, you know, like wherever there's an opportunity to exploit someone and that person, you know, can do it, I think that's really inexcusable. What they were doing was something that was not necessarily acceptable at that time. But if you look back at it now and see those films now that she was producing then, I don't think anyone would be really feel as though there was exploitation in that. But that was then. And I think that today's porn industry is very different. I mean, what's going on today in terms of, you know, what's happening on the internet and what's available and so forth and so on. I mean, there's no comparison. what she was doing.
Do you think that people are more miserable sexually today than they were back then?
I don't know if they're more miserable. I think people have lost a sense of community, and I think people have lost a sense of humanity in that there are these immediate kind of gratifications that people have learned to expect, which has nothing to do with human relationships and kind of go beyond. I don't know how to explain. I mean, it depresses me to think about what goes on today. It's very depressing to hear Greek news and to hear about all these abuse that's going on, you know, familial abuse between, you know, like fathers and children and mothers and so forth and so on. I think it's just gone beyond.
Because Shelley, she was surrounded by people who actually loved her. And it seems that relations were more vivid then than today, where we have the screens and the internet and everything. People are lonelier. Don't you find that there is a comparison? I think you draw a comparison between those two worlds by showing how she became friends with some people, regardless of their sexual identity, and she stayed with them as friends for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely. Well, I think that those were real relationships. That's why, you know, if you think about an exploitative relationship, if one is exploited, they don't want to continue that relationship, right? Because there is always going to be that element of feeling exploited. Whereas I think that what you see when you see these people after years and years and years of having known her, they don't feel as they were exploited. I mean, it's like playing a game that, you know, if you lose, you lose. But that's okay because, you know, like it's played fairly. It's not a sense of being duped. I mean, sure, I'm sure she was, you know, like, you can't be a successful businesswoman without kind of taking certain risks and whatnot. But I find that people here, just living in Greece these past few years, I see that there's a lot more on the personal level. There's a lot more deception.
Kind of like the Greek family has been sort of sanctified, right?
Absolutely. And one should not sanctify anyone. We have to just look at things with eyes open, you know. And also I think that she was pretty straightforward, and I think that, you know, we seem to underestimate that. But it's refreshing to have people that say things to your face rather than have to hear it from someone else. And I think that people really did appreciate that. I'm just going to go back to, you know, like just saying that I think that regardless of what people might have thought, I think that she was quite respectful of people, and I think she was also interested in people. I think that's pretty important.
The way you depict her, obviously, she's a woman who wouldn't take no for an answer. She seemed quite tough and very decisive in whatever she did. I'm sure that comes also from her quite harsh past. But I noticed in your film one line that she said, which was, I believe, her soft spot. It was the moment when I think was her daughter, if I'm not mistaken, in the interview who asked her. She was depressed because obviously her family was lost in the Holocaust in Salonika. And for many years she was depressed and she would be sleepless, etc. But she also said one thing to her daughter, could you actually bring me a Nazi to kill him? And I think that is probably the most sentimental line that I heard from her throughout the film. No or not?
Yeah, but I mean, don't forget, she lost her help, you know, like she lost everyone.
Obviously.
And she almost lost,
obviously.
You know, that was wishful thinking, but I'm not sure that, you know, like she had a gun or something that she would actually shoot them. I don't know.
No, not in that sense.
I'm not in that position. I haven't been through anything remotely as painful as, you know, what she went through.
And she did warn them before she left.
Absolutely. Absolutely she did. They all laughed at her in the sense that, you know, where is she going? And she's like, you know. I mean, and I met a couple of people who knew her at that time and remembered that and specifically told me, it's not in the film, but they specifically said that, you know, like Shelley was telling us, you know, to leave, to go to the States. And we were telling her, are you kidding me? Go to the States? Why? You know, blah, blah. And then a few years later, you know, like, they survived, though, because they were in Athens. But in the end, they were in the States, because that's where I met them.
those who stayed in Athens survived, and those who actually went to Thessaloniki didn't.
Exactly, yeah, because the Nazis didn't, you know, come down to Athens as forcefully as they did in Thessaloniki.
Filming a feature documentary with scenes from the past can be quite a challenge, and I was actually very impressed by your animation. What difficulties did you face in the process, and how long did it take you to film a documentary on a person you knew when you were 15? Obviously, she helped you with your first job, so it was an emotional experience.
It was, but it was a long time ago. But there were a couple of questions in what you just asked me. How difficult was bringing the past into the film?
And the footage you found.
The footage, we were very lucky because Bondi's husband, the daughter Bondi, her younger daughter, her husband was a director, a film director. And so he also, you know, would make these soft porn films. Later on in life, he started making home videos with Celli. And so a lot of the home videos are theirs. And they were very, very kind to let me use them, which helped us very much. And then, of course, we have the archival footage. But the animation, I had to be able to somehow bring Celli to life, you know, as a character beyond the archival material. I wanted to use animation from the beginning, but animation is very expensive. And so, you know, being an independent production, I thought, oh, I'll never manage to do the animation. But we have a co-producer who's Canadian, very, very wonderful person. And at some point, he got a grant, and he said, you know, I managed to get this grant. What do you want to use the money for? And I said, the animation. And he said, okay. So I managed to do the animation. And we interviewed various animators in Canada. And this one woman who did our animation, Indian-Canadian, we had long conversations. I sent her all of the archival material, the home videos of Celli, and photographs and so forth and so on. We spoke a lot. And she started drawing images of Celli. And she managed to get Celli's kind of mojo, as they say. You know, like she got her. And it made it really wonderful. I think it gave film such another layer because you really think that she's there. And it was really well edited by Rob Ruzick, Canadian editor. And it was all done, I thought, you know, like the editing with the animation. I think it brings Celli to life. It's just really wonderful. I mean, I would have never been able to do that if we hadn't gotten that grant from Canadians.
Have her children seen the film?
Yes, everyone has. Of course, I couldn't.
What
Sorry,
do they
I'm
say?
Laughing, but, you know, because you're always nervous. You know, what are they going to think? Are they going to like it? You know, are they going to be offended? But I think that they enjoyed it. And if anything, you know, like when one of the grandchildren said, you know, like you've really helped us, you know, have a legacy for our grandmother. You know, it was really wonderful for them to say something like that. Because when you see the film, you see that one of the granddaughters, you know, discusses this whole thing about, was she exploiting other women in her film? So you can't help but, you know, if you're a thinking person and a woman, to wonder, you know, like, did she exploit women or didn't she? And in the end, I think you come to terms with things. You learn to understand and to look at the fuller picture rather than just a narrow view of what was going on.
When I was watching the film, because, okay, she starts by being forced into having sex with her first husband and then her second husband, and then she ends up being with women. But it's quite fascinating, her whole character. And how you basically manage to bring it back to life.
I think what you said is very interesting because, like, people hear about, of porn and so forth and so on, and immediately, you know, we have all of our kind of lingo and ways of thinking where we kind of interpret things the way we think they are rather than just being open. And it's kind of like having a meal. You know, you say, oh, you know, I don't like fish. But, you know, like you have to try fish in order to see that you don't like it. Or, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that we have to be open to things. And I think when we're open to things, we can understand them better and either appreciate them or even negate them. But you have to kind of be open. I think that that's something that I had to come to terms with myself in order to make the film. I think that there's a strong sense of empowerment, of course. You know, like, it's first and foremost, I think it's for women because we're the ones usually who need to feel empowered, to have a sense of strength of some sort in terms of being able to stand on our own 2 feet and to value ourselves as people, first and foremost. And I think that that's basically the bottom line as far as the film goes. But I hope for people who watch it that it's empowering. That's all I can say as far as ultimately what I want out of this film.
Valerie, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us and to give us your view about the film and about the values of this film.
Well, thank you. It's very nice speaking with you. I hope people see it and enjoy the film and get something out of it.
Can you tell us when it premieres?
It'll be March 10th and 11th in Thessaloniki at the Dark Festival.
Thank you, Valerie. Have a very nice day.
Thank you. You too.
And that was director Valerie Kontakos speaking to our Infinite Curious program of The Voice of Greece about her new film, Queen of Juice, on the life of the queen of porn, Greek-born Shelley Wilson, in the 25th Thessaloniki Documentary Festival, which this year takes place from the 2nd to the 12th of March. Viewers will get to watch issues of gender oppression and portraits of female empowerment, testimonies and documents that look back at historical traumas and shocking events. Documentaries that send a distress signal for the environment and our planet, documenting the violence and discrimination faced by all kinds of diversity. The 34 documentaries and the competition sections, including 9 Greek productions, deal with the most pressing issues of our time. The film that wins the Golden Alexander in the international competition automatically finds a place on the shortlist for the Best Documentary Oscar. Angelos Rallis' film, Mighty Afrin in the Time of Floods, and Valerie Kontakos' Queen of the Juice are only 2 of the finest examples of how documentaries have such a strong impact on changing our views and attitudes in this complex world we live in. Join us for another exciting human experience next week, where we'll be definitely be challenging the infinite curiosity of our minds in another of our Infinite Curious programs. I'm Katerina Badzaki. Thank you for joining us. And more, same time next week.
On the journey, you are searching for your meaning. No. It seems to find you, or so it seems. But still he calls you, and if you listen, he will lead you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. To that higher place where his glory.
η φωνή της Ελλάδας, φωνή όλων των Ελλήνων. Εφτά τραγούδια θα σου πω. Το τραγούδι της Κυριακής. Ήτανε αέρας. Στίχη Γιώργος Χορονάς. Μουσική Γιώργος Καζαντζής. Ερμηνεία Λιζέτα Καλημέρη.
Σε τρέχει.